We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Mr. President, you're driving us crazy. You're winning too much.
I'm a man. I am an anchor man. I'm a man who discovered the wheel and built the Eiffel Tower out of metal and bronze. That's what kind of man I am.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
I got into broadcasting because I like to give. Sometimes I found myself hurting from giving too much.
Now, Mark Reardon.
Mark Reardon, ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together and give a warm welcome to this guy.
On KMOX.
It's go time. It's go time time. It's go, no go, lock and load, love him and leave him, smoke him if you got him, see you when I see you, because it's time for Mark Reardon time.
Back up, you creep. Get away from me.
Tuesday afternoon in St. Louis. Beautiful, beautiful. Well, I don't know if it's beautiful. It's nice temperatures, though. Beautiful temperature. Could we say that? Beautiful temperatures. That sounds like something that Trump would say. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful temperatures out there in Missouri.
It's pronounced Gina.
In fact, it is. Hey, you know what I did? I didn't mention this yesterday. I did this on Sunday afternoon, and I'm just going to tell you right now, I could not be more of a hypocrite because, Dave Klein, you know what my rule is on Christmas lights, right? You remember it specifically?
Well, you can't flip them on before Thanksgiving. Is that right?
You could put them on your house before Thanksgiving.
But you can't turn them on.
Do not turn those things on before Thanksgiving. Punishment would be what?
There's a fine, right?
You're in jail.
Right.
And or a fine.
Right.
Right?
I think that's fair.
On the backside of that, after Christmas, remember the rule?
No, I actually don't remember this part of the rule.
Basically, you can leave the lights on. You know, I think I would even give leeway through, if we craft this legislation properly, I'd say through the second week of January, right? Because I like the holidays and I like the Christmas lights up and everything like that. But you have to get those lights off of your house by when?
Oh, I would say February at the latest.
February at the latest, right? So there's a two-part equation for the Christmas lights on my house. One, on the house themselves. Like, I'm not getting on the ladder on my roof. Right? I'm too old for that. I'm not going to do it. So I have this guy, Andrew, that comes over, does a great job. I do put the lights up on the trees, right? You know when those lights came down?
I'm guessing the day after Christmas.
Sunday. This past Sunday.
On your tree?
No, on my trees outside.
Oh,
okay. My outdoor trees.
Gotcha. All right.
In other words, I it's like a two-part process. The Andrew puts up the lights on the house, and then I put all the trees because I can do that easily. But I did not. This is why I said it's hypocrisy. I'm just being honest here in case some of my neighbors have heard my position on Christmas lights, and I'm the only one on the block that had it on the trees. Now, I mentioned something to my next-door neighbor the other day. I was joking. I'm like, hey, I'm finally getting the Christmas lights out. He goes, well, I didn't even notice them.
Oh, like, come on. He didn't?
Well, they were just, you know, simple white lights that would blend into the trees. I was half tempted to just go with it here into the spring because before you know it, the leaves will be back on the trees and then nobody would know. And we get to the point where November rolls around and say, hey, my lights are on there, right?
Now,
I feel terrible, though, because
should.
I've made fun of people relentlessly for years for doing exactly the same thing. And I'm guilty. I'm just going to tell you. So you're in jail, punishable by a fine. I could be a victim of my own circumstances, Dave.
Now, we've had several nice weather days here recently that you could have done it, and you waited until Sunday.
You're right. I know. That is bad, isn't it?
It's laziness.
It is laziness. Well, you got that nailed. All right. Anyway, we're off and running here for a Tuesday afternoon. And yeah, don't do what I did. If you have the funny thing is I haven't even seen anyone else, certainly in my neighborhood, that has their Christmas lights up. In my old neighborhood, there were people that were flagrant violators. But I would make fun of them on this radio station, wouldn't I?
You would. You know, yeah. I managed to get mine down 2 weeks after Christmas
That's
while my
good.
Twin boys were taking a nap.
That's pretty good, Dave.
Thank you.
You know what you should have done? We don't live that far from one another. You should have swung on over to my house and said, you know what? I'm in the mood to take down Christmas lights, and I'm going to do your house, too. You could have done that.
That's the giving spirit.
I'm an idiot. I actually put something on Instagram stories for those people who want to follow. It's at Mark Talk is my handle. I said, some idiot from the neighborhood finally took down their Christmas lights, and I had a picture of my daughter and I taking down the lights the other day. Anyway, all right, so we're off and running here. Let's see. We have some stuff that came out yesterday. Thank you, Dave. Back into the producer's cave you go, and he's going to help out with phone calls and everything else this afternoon. So there is, it looks like, from what we know, Kim Gardner, who is the circuit attorney here in St. Louis, who has, well, let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, there's really no other issues, pressing issues in her office. It's not like people are getting killed and murdered every day and you have violent crime and all that. She's got to focus on whether or not there was a picture taken of someone who had a consensual affair with the governor of the state of Missouri and has yet to speak or make any claims about this, right? Outside of being recorded by her now ex-husband, who probably wasn't too happy that she was catting around. But there are people now that are being apparently subpoenaed to come before this grand jury. Which, just by the way, just because there's an investigation and just because there's a grand jury, that doesn't mean that charges will be issued. I know there's a lot of anticipation, like by Jane Duker, who's just frothing at the mouth at the notion that there should be or will be charges here with the governor. So Scott Faughn is going to join us from the Missouri Times. Then I'm really looking forward. I found this piece in Vanity Fair. I think I referenced it on Thursday afternoon. From Chris Whipple. Chris Whipple is a guy who wrote a book called The Gatekeepers, and he went back and talked to all these former White House chiefs of staff. He did not have Reince Priebus in the book that came out last year. It was about a year ago, more than that, I think, and we had a conversation. Well, somehow, and I can't wait to ask him about this, he managed to get Reince to sit down and give him an interview, a detailed interview. He's turned that into an update for the book, for the paperback version, which comes out in a couple of weeks. So it's good publicity for his book. It's also a coup because nobody else has talked to the former chief of staff. I think he sat down with Bannon, too. He's going to join me a little later this hour.
Your home for the best blues coverage. America's Sports Voice. KMOX. For the
land of the free. I guess, oh, man, that's so painful. I guess Fergie came out, and I think he had to kind of do this and confront the issue. And the more I listened to that painfully yesterday, I did think that, yeah, I know she was trying to do something. It's hard to be too rough on her, even though she sounded like Marilyn Monroe singing to President Kennedy. But she came out and has apologized. She said, I've been honored and proud. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, she got a big chair on that. I've always been honored and proud to perform the national anthem. And last night I wanted to try something special for the NBA. I'm a risk taker artistically, but clearly this rendition didn't strike the intended tone. I think she's right about that. So we'll just leave it at that and let Fergie move forward. I mentioned what's going on here in the circuit attorney's office, Kim Gardner, who is apparently calling together a grand jury to look into Governor Greitens and the allegation that he may have done something inappropriate during his consensual relationship with the hairstylist that he had an affair with. The question, according to the audio tape that was produced by her ex-husband, is whether or not there was a picture taken when she was tied up or naked and whether or not she had given permission for that picture and whether or not he threatened to use that picture in the future in a blackmail fashion. Scott Faughn from the Missouri Times with me this afternoon. How are you?
Doing very well, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good for a Tuesday. So what's your sense in Jefferson City about what's going on here?
You know, obviously when there's investigators in the Capitol, as there are again today, talking to lawmakers about the governor, dark money, sexual issue, yeah, that takes up all the oxygen in the room, whether it be a Republican or a Democrat governor. So a lot of folks are, if they're not actually talking to investigators, they're talking about it or talking to people that have. And I mean, it's a unique situation when it's in session in the Capitol and there's a scandal, there's a different buzz and electricity to this building that is kind of as unique to anything else you'll experience. So a lot of folks in the state are just kind of sitting back and waiting. I think next week they may start some grand jury testimony and waiting to see what happens.
Yeah, so the question here would be, and I mentioned, I think everybody knows at this point what happened with the affair and the allegation about the picture, but we've got several people who now have confirmed that they have been at least involved in conversations with some investigators, including the House Speaker Todd Richardson. And this sort of jumped out at me here from Nate Walker, who's a Republican of Kirksville, who said that it seems like these investigators are looking into matters that go beyond criminal allegations related to his affair. The quote was, they're looking into some things in the governor's office. They ask a lot of questions. Good investigators investigate everything. So obviously the possibility that the whatever the dark money contributions, I don't even know what else they'd be looking at this point. It sounds to a certain extent like a fishing expedition, but I don't know.
I think there's, I mean, the legislators all say they ask about the phone call the governor made to hear what his story was. And then it's the conversation at Jefferson City here about dark money. I know another one of his former staffers are being interviewed today. It's about the use of the Confide app. It's about the dark money. And to a certain extent, the ones that were at the campaign, I know, have been asked a lot about the fundraising list from the Mission Continues that was used for political purposes, which would be potential violation of the law. I think that keep in mind, Nate Walker was on the staff of the Attorney General, Bill Webster. He went to jail. Probably the biggest scandal besides this one time going back would be when he ran for governor. So a lot of folks have remembered that, especially Nate Walker, who worked in that office. So yeah, I mean, it looks like the investigators are asking the legislators about dark money situations. And I think the reason for that, especially with the fundraising list, are the Mission Continues was headquartered in the city of St. Louis. So,
yeah, but that seems to be a broad sweeping investigation that was sparked by the extramarital affair and the audio tape, right?
I would say that there's no question that there was law enforcement agencies interested in the dark money. I think they are using it in a unique way that hasn't been done before. And I think with a lot of these dark money things, no one really knows what's against the law and what's not. The law is written very vague, and it's pretty much a new concept, so there's not a lot of testing. I think when these things started, other people started talking about things more than just the affair. And frankly, I mean, it's a fact in politics. When you're a popular governor with a lot going for you, and maybe even White House aspirations, people aren't as willing to tell stories as you are when you're not a popular governor. And I think that may be part of this. Now, whether any charges come from that, I'm kind of pessimistic. I think the view in the Capitol is, if the woman alleges something was done to her that was illegal, they probably are going to prosecute on it, and the courts will decide the truth.
But that's if she alleges something, right? I don't know that would be decided on the basis of whatever her ex-husband told the grand jury, and I'm guessing they could play those tapes in court as well. I don't think there'd be any restrictions on that, but she would have to be subpoenaed, and I'm sure that she will be, and have to, I guess, say something and testify. She could always take the fifth, couldn't she?
I think she could during
grand jury or not.
I don't know that you could take the fifth in a grand jury, but I can. I mean, I think the common sense facts are, if she doesn't want to tell the story of whatever happened, or if she tells the story and that doesn't happen to have broken any laws, I don't think they charge the guy with a crime. I think most folks in Jeff City are willing to wait and see what happens. And then if she does come out and allege some laws were broken, then I think you're going to see a different posture. I think the Republicans here have, thus far, the governor has said pretty much that she was lying on the tape. The Republicans in Jeff City, because she's not personally speaking out to contradict that, have kind of let things simmer. He makes it very clear that he's not going to give up a political career. I think that they're willing to let that situation go. I mean, he's in a pretty weak posture. He's frankly treating them nicer than he ever has. So some of them are willing to let this situation play out. I think the only thing that would change that would be if there's a criminal charge. And the way I understand it, the only way there's a criminal charge is if the woman tells a story and alleges there was some criminal wrongdoing.
Yeah, well, and by the way, I looked that up. It appears as if she could take the fifth if she's worried that something she would say could incriminate her. But if she's subpoenaed, she would have to at least take the stand or show up. And if you don't show up, you could face, you know, a warrant for your arrest as well. So as far as the governing that's going on down there in Jeff City, it's not exactly business as usual, though, because of all this hanging over the governor's head, is it?
Oh, of course not. I mean, there's no... You can't have a scandal like this that touches politics, money, and sex and say that things are normal. It's certainly not normal. in an odd way, they've actually moved some things because they're sort of, you know, disregarding the governor. And I think part of the conflict last year was the governor attacking them and them attacking him. And he's kind of just, I mean, he's campaigning for a tax bill that has already been shelved in committee. I think the fact that he's kind of stepped back has allowed them to function somewhat more normally on big issues. But yes, it definitely hangs over. And then, of course, you have this cadre of South County legislators that have come up with a bill to penalize up to a year in jail people that leave their Christmas lights up.
Well, I would, you know, even though I'm a flagrant offender of that, I would support that legislation, Scott. Yeah. I'm a hypocrite. I'm just like any other lawmaker out there. I'm a hypocrite. What can I say?
You'd fit in. You should run.
You know what? I should, damn it. All right, Scott Fawn from the Missouri Times. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
There are some implications for this very radio program on Friday. We have a Reardon Roundtable scheduled, of course, 2 o'clock. That's must-listen-to radio. You can't go into the weekend without that. So we're going to air it and have it live here in the studio as soon as the game is over. We may start at 2:45. We may start at 3:10. But one way or the other, we're going to get the Reardon Roundtable in on Friday. So this afternoon, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the gun issue. I got a great piece from Hugh Hewitt, who wrote some, I think, productive suggestions for how to move forward and get some solutions when it comes to gun violence. So I'll share those and get your opinions and take some phone calls probably in the next hour. I mentioned Chris Whipple. So Chris was with me a little bit more than a year ago because he wrote a book called The Gatekeepers, and he interviewed all these living White House chiefs of staff and sat down with everyone, and Reince Priebus was just taken office, so he was not included. However, he is included now because Chris got an exclusive interview with him. He's updated that book, The Gatekeepers, for a paperback version, which is coming up here in just a couple of weeks. Chris Whipple, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back.
I remember when we talked about this, I knew it was too early to ask you about Reince Priebus because he was just getting into the job, so we didn't exactly know how this was going to turn out. But lo and behold, you tracked him down. I thought he had vanished from the planet.
Well, yeah, you know, he hasn't given any extensive interviews since that day that he stepped out onto that rainy tarmac at Andrews Air Force Base, and he was tweeted out of his job, as you may recall. These are his first interviews since then, and it was, we all know now that the first 6 months of this White House were the most, it was the most dysfunctional White House in modern history, but it turns out we didn't know the half of it. I mean, the first thing that Priebus told me was that he said, take everything you know and multiply it by 50. Now, he would hasten to add that John Kelly also thinks that it was the toughest job he ever had, but it was a wild ride. And in the new paperback, which comes out March 6th of The Gatekeepers, I have Priebus' story of that first 6 months and also new interviews with Steve Bannon.
Did you have a relationship with Reince before this, or how did you convince him to sit down with you?
I did not, and it was a long, painstaking process of starting with a dinner that was completely off the record, another long sit-down that was completely off the record, and then a process of persuading him to put things on the record. He still cherishes his, this may be hard to believe, but he still treasures his relationship with President Trump. He doesn't want to jeopardize it. And yet, he was pretty candid about the wild roller coaster ride from that very first day on January 21 when Trump called him at home after seeing Obama's inaugural photo next to his own, livid, furious, demanding that Priebus somehow change the narrative. The rest is history, as they say.
Well, and I want to talk about some of those issues, but I also want you, this is an open invitation, to feel free to drop in anything, Chris, that may have been off the record that you want to put on the record, just in case okay. We want to break some news here. You're free to do that. I'm going to give you free reign. But on the, so this thing starts off right away with this inauguration fiasco, right?
Yeah. And Trump was absolutely livid, screaming at Priebus over the phone. It was about a little after 6 a.m. on the morning of the 21st of January. Priebus remembers thinking to himself, am I going to go to war with the President of the United States on day one? Do we really need to have a huge controversy over the inaugural photos? Well, the answer, of course, is no, they didn't need it. But as we all now know, Sean Spicer stepped up to the podium and told those flagrant lies, then That was, you know, truth was the first casualty of this presidency on day one. That's on Priebus. It's not just on Sean Spicer and Donald Trump.
So this is interesting, and I maybe you wrote about this in the original book before the updated version. If you're just joining me, Chris Whipple's my guest. The Gatekeeper is the name of his book. He did this book last year about all the White House chiefs of staff, basically from the past 50 years, and now he's got a part in the updated paperback about Reince Priebus. And did they, you describe in the piece that was in Vanity Fair about this breakfast that sometimes takes place between previous chiefs of staff to give advice to incoming chiefs. And there's a quote in here from Jack Watson, who served President Carter, and he basically says, "We wished him luck. We were telling him the truth, but he doesn't have a prayer." They kind of knew going in, right? Because it's a tough job no matter who the president is, but maybe even tougher with this president.
Yeah, it was Godspeed, God help him, was the attitude of most of those chiefs when they left. They were not optimistic going in to this lunch with Priebus. They were even less hopeful coming out. And by the way, in the middle of this meeting where they went around the table and tried to give Priebus their best advice, Barack Obama, who was still president, walked into the room, and he looked at his former chiefs. There were four of them there at the table. And he looked at Priebus, and he said, "You know what? Every one of these guys told me things that pissed me off. But they were right to do it. They were sometimes right. And that's the most important thing a White House chief of staff can do, and I hope you do it for President Trump." And off he went. Well, when the chiefs of staff left this meeting, this private meeting with Priebus, most of them came away discouraged because they felt that Priebus had no idea what he was getting into, that he was that he really was not prepared and hadn't given much thought to how to create the infrastructure that you need as White House chief. Anyway, it was, as we all know, the most dysfunctional 6 months probably in presidential history.
You know, I know Reince pretty well. I've lost contact with him here in the past 2 years. We worked together in Milwaukee when I was up there, and he used to come on the show all the time, and I'm hoping maybe to reconnect with him in the future. But I will say this, I was surprised even when his name was being tossed around and that he got the gig, because it just didn't seem like it was a good fit.
Well, it wasn't. We know that now, and I think that Priebus, again, in fairness to him, he was very successful as head of the RNC, as we know, raised a lot of money. He just wasn't prepared to tell Donald Trump hard truths. That's the most important job anybody can do, and Priebus would tell you, he would argue that for every half-baked, ill-conceived thing that Trump actually did during those first 6 months, that he, Priebus, managed to stop 10 worse ideas. When I talked to Steve Bannon, Bannon agreed. He said, "I think Reince stopped 20 bad ideas. Since, let me tell you something, 10 of them were mine." Bannon was pretty funny and pretty candid. But anyway, you know, at the end of the day, Reince Priebus was ill-equipped to do the job, but also unempowered by Donald Trump. And every one of the former White House chiefs told him, "Don't take the job unless you're empowered as first among equals." Well, that wasn't going to happen in the first 6 months.
What eventually then, was there a breaking point that led to him resigning or being dismissed?
Yeah. The breaking point for Priebus, and he tells the story in the new chapter of the paperback, which is out March 6th. You can pre-order it now. The breaking point was when Anthony Scaramucci, that famous loose cannon, came rolling onto the deck.
The Mooch. We call him the Mooch here, Chris. Just so you know, you can call him the Mooch. It's okay.
So the Mooch came rolling onto this deck at the White House, and he had that infamous expletive-laden tirade with the New Yorker magazine, and he accused, as Reince put it, when he started accusing me of a felony, which was basically all but saying that Priebus had leaked Scaramucci's financial information, which was publicly available. Anyway, he said, when this guy started accusing me of a felony, and when Donald Trump said nothing in Priebus's defense, at that point, Priebus said, "I just went to him and I said, look, time for me to go."
But he basically, then he finds out, you write this in the new chapter, does he find out from a tweet that he's been replaced?
Yeah. He does, and you know what? They were on Air Force One. They were on the tarmac and at Andrews Air Force Base. Trump, without any warning to either Reince Priebus or John Kelly, who did not know he was about to get the job as White House chief, Trump tweets, "I am appointing John Kelly is my new White House Chief of Staff, and thanks, Reince, for your service," and that was it.
But he's not, are you saying he's not bitter about this?
Well, he may be bitter. If he's bitter about it, he hides it pretty well. You know, I think he knew it was time to go. Every White House chief needs to be ready to go at any time and ready to resign, and quite frankly, there are a bunch of them who should have resigned sooner than they did. But if you have any awareness of what's going on around you, you should be ready to go when you're no longer helping the president.
The Gatekeepers is the name of the book, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Chris Whipple was a guest last year when the book first came out. The new edition paper book, March 6th, is out, and Reince Priebus will have the updated chapter. Look at it this way, Chris. By the time of this administration, just the first, you know, the first 4 years, you might have three more updates for this book.
We could have three more or four or five more chiefs of staff. You never know.
You'll never have to work again. You just keep updating the chiefs of staff from the Trump White House.
That's right. That's right.
Hey, thank you so much for coming on here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Chris Whipple on KMOX. Here's what's on tap this afternoon, sponsored by the Butterfly House at Faust Park in Chesterfield. There was a skier that was in the halfpipe event last night that really basically had no skill at the halfpipe at all, but she was in the Olympics. How in the world did that happen? This is an amazing story. I'll explain next. I'm watching the Olympics last night. I felt so bad, and I can never remember the names, but there was a young girl who had won gold in the halfpipe event. Now, this is not the halfpipe with the snowboards. It's the Shaun White thing is different with the snowboards. This is also not the half pipe that you might harken back to from your college days. That's something different as well. But they're doing the same thing, I guess, they do with the snowboards. You can ski on the half pipe run. And there was the one girl who's American, who was the defending gold medalist. She fell three times on her run last night. You had to do just one without falling, or at least, you know, it's your best score of three runs. And it just didn't work out. So I felt badly for her. And that's what happens in these Olympic competitions. You got some people rising to the top. You know what I saw the other day? There was a guy who won, I can't remember if it was an American. I think it was an American who won the silver medal in the short track event because everybody else fell down. All the other people who were skating with him, he kind of got into second position behind the favorite. And then everyone wrecked and crashed. So the guy wins a medal out of that. But that's, you know, I guess that's part of the process. But then there's this story. So I'm popping around. I'm watching the freestyle halfpipe thing last night with skis. And I saw something on Twitter that was fascinating about a woman by the name of Elizabeth Swainy, who is on the Hungarian halfpipe team. Let me just play this for you here. Now, this is not the coverage from NBC. I'm not sure exactly who's doing the coverage here. But this is Elizabeth Swainy's run on the halfpipe.
Elizabeth Swainy from Hungary, out of Oakland, California now, 34th in the World Cup.
Okay, that's important there. She got 34th in the World Cup. Well, we'll explain that in just a second, why that happened.
The 13th in the half pipe at Secret Garden earlier in the year. What can she deliver on here in Pyeongchang?
Now, what she's doing basically is skiing. If you could ski, you could basically, I think, do what she did.
Up to the top of the wall, going for these grabs, the safety grab you'll see there.
Yeah, it's all she's doing is skiing up and down the pipe. That's it. Just basically.
Opting for another, just cruising up to the top of the wall, showing the judges she can make it down this half pipe clean.
That's all she's doing is showing the judges she can do it without falling.
Bottom, one to the left, and then a nice cruise. 360 to switch.
Now, I can't believe that they're calling it the way they're calling it, because that was fascinating. How in the world can you make it into the Olympics without doing any tricks? That's what they call them. You know, you get up above the halfpipe, you do this, the spins, the... I learned all kinds of things about the 180 and the 360 and the 540 and the 900 and you name it. The 1120. Oh, that's KMOX. But you get my point. So here's a primer, if you will, on Olympic qualifying, ladies and gentlemen. This year, there were 24 quota spots available for the Winter Olympics in the women's ski halfpipe. But those spots do not automatically go to the best 24 skiers in the world. Why would you want that? Why would you want the best skiers in the world at the Olympics? That sounds stupid. That's silly, right? That's kind of nonsense. Yeah. So, the maximum number of skiers that each nation can send for women's halfpipe is 4. So, the U.S. had 6 skiers ranked inside the top 20 of the Olympic qualifying standings, but they could only send 4 skiers, even though they had more than 4 athletes. So you have countries like the U.S. who have to forego the extra spots. Some countries don't use their quota spots for that particular event, and other athletes pull out. You know, have injuries and things like that, or at least some people may plan on competing in the halfpipe, and then they go for the Lindsey Vonn's doing this tonight with the combined. She skipped the downhill, and she's doing combined. I think that's what it is. Or Michaela was doing that. One of them's doing that. Who knows? You get my point. Sometimes they switch events, right? So then the invite list goes all the way down to athlete number 34. Athlete number 34 in the rankings worldwide is Elizabeth Sweeney of Hungary. The International Ski Federation, which governs the sport, has minimum requirements for athletes to be eligible. All you have to do is finish in the top 30 at a World Cup event, and you have to score a minimum number of FIS points. FIS is the International Ski Federation. So Sweeney meets those requirements. For halfpipe, there's not a big field, right? So you have a lot of athletes, fewer than 30 athletes competing. So as long as she shows up and drops in for a run, and I mean literally drops in, that's all she does, she's guaranteed a top 30 finish and at least a few points at all those qualifying events. So that's what she did. For the last couple of years, Elizabeth Sweeney went to qualifying events. Sometimes girls would crash, so she wasn't even dead last. You heard the announcer say she was 13th. She's only 13th because of attrition. And I don't know, maybe there were 13 entrants into that. So she didn't even clear the lip of the half pipe. She didn't grab for any tricks. She didn't spin beyond a 180, but she didn't fall. Her first run had 5, and they describe it this way, featured, quote-unquote, 5 straight airs, an alley-oop 180, and then another straight air. This sort of run is one you might see from a weekend warrior at, you know, Hidden Valley, essentially. So if you're at Hidden Valley this week and you can do that, you should probably try to qualify for the Olympics in 2022. This Elizabeth Sweeney is fascinating, by the way. She said, and she did not qualify for the finals. That's why you did not see her last night. So this was one of the runs before the finals. They say that her other notable exploit has been running for governor of California as a 19-year-old and also attempting to become an Olympic skeleton athlete for Venezuela. She says that her motivations are pure. She hopes that her trip to the Olympics can be an inspiration. She says, and by the way, the reason that she's on the Hungary team is that's another little, you know, let's see if I can find out here. She was with the Hungarian delegation. I think she has some relevance to Hungary, but that was sort of a trick in and of itself. So her comment was, I want to inspire others in Hungary and the world to become involved in freestyle skiing. Maybe perhaps I'm the bridge of those who want to get started in the life of freestyle skiing. I want to show people that, yeah, it's possible to get involved in freestyle skiing through a variety of backgrounds. I think the better lesson here from Elizabeth Sweeney is that if you want to be an Olympic athlete, and this is like Eddie the Eagle. Isn't this very similar to Eddie the Eagle? And that's a pretty good movie that came out in the last couple of years. I mean, it's one of those touchy-feely Disney-type movies about the guy from England who, what was that? Was it 88 or something, or maybe into the 90s, where he competed in ski jumping and he went to all these qualifying events. And I don't know if that was her inspiration, but certainly it was very similar to that. But if you want, we got to decide on Olympic event for, maybe there's time to do this in 2 years to get into the Summer Olympics, because I've always wanted to be an Olympic athlete. And I think there's a path now, ladies and gentlemen. Second hour coming up.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.